Leon.
Hello and welcome to episode 101 of Lunch with Leon. Thank you firstly for all the tremendous responses for our last episode, episode 100 of course, with Peter Lord Hendy of Richmond Hill, the Minister of State for Rail, who was my guest last time. And so many of you wrote or called and sent messages to say how much you enjoyed it. Well, of course, I can't bring us a government minister every episode, but it is pretty remarkable amongst podcasts to get over 100 episodes. Many of them start and die off quite quickly, so thank you for all of your support over the years downloading these episodes. And I know that new people join, and I can see the flicker in some of the older episodes as they go back and explore some of the older ones. So thanks again for all your support. People listen to this podcast because they enjoy the guests, and they do it while they're walking the dog, cycling, travelling to work, out on the run, that sort of thing. We stay on audio because apart from the great help I get from Mel Stark and her great team at Stark Communications, most of the production of this podcast is done by me in my spare time. And of course, I don't have much spare time, so please bear with me if we stay with audio. I hope you really enjoy it. I've had a really busy time the last few weeks. I had a really great all-day visit to RAF Northolt, and I was able to do that because I was a guest, thanks to the Worshipful Company of Carmen, where I am master this year. And if you're a Carmen, you can enjoy all sorts of events, social events, lunch, dinner, trips. And RAF Northolt was an amazing trip. We saw the British Forces Post Office headquarters, spoke to some really interesting people. We visited the headquarters of the RAF orchestras. On all these things taking place alongside military planes taking off and landing with supplies and so on. All absolutely amazing at RAF Northolt, and a benefit of being in the Worshipful Company of Carmen. Go to our website. You too might enjoy the events, the opportunity to get together and meet with colleagues and broaden your whole circle of professional friends. Also recently, I was really pleased to go to the 55 Society's 75th year celebrations. People who've been employed by London Transport, its predecessors and successors, including Transport for London, a great place where we meet old friends from our previous working lives. And most recently, I was very privileged to welcome 107 members of the London Bus Preservation Trust to our annual general meeting, where we had a really good talk through many of the issues that are facing museums such as ours, the challenges facing preservation of old vehicles, especially the ones powered by internal combustion engines, of course. And it was so great to have everybody together. Again, if you'd like to see more, come down and see us at Brooklands Museum. Again, you'll find that on the London Bus Museum website, also the Brooklands Museum website. Come down and see us. You'll see planes, cars, bikes, and of course, lots of old London buses. Well, there's some news from me. What's up for this episode? Well, I'm really delighted to have as my guest the Chief Executive of Thames Clippers, Sean Collins. Thames Clippers is a really successful high-speed ferry service on the River Thames, bringing people from as far west as Putney and as far east as Barking Riverside to and from various locations in the centre of London, in the city and out in Westminster. We carry tourists, we carry commuters, workers, and we carry people, as I say, just for pleasure as well as need. The service is run from very early till very late every day, and I was really pleased to catch up with Sean and really just ask him how it all began.
Well, it all started through my disappointment, I guess, in that a river bus service that started in the 80s called Thames Line, that had a very short life, that then became the River Bus Partnership, predominantly supported by the owners of Canary Wharf at the time, Olympia and York, a Canadian company. And they heavily supported it, but unfortunately, their development got into financial difficulties and was led to administration. And that then put the spotlight on River Bus, that ultimately resulted in its demise in the early 90s. And I started work there at the age of 18 as a crew member and then became a captain. And I see the potential. And then a good few years passed after the demise of Riverbus, where I hoped to try and get three new boats that were built, 9, 10 and 11, three new Riverbuses that were built on the Isle of Wight by FBM Marine, back into service, which I failed. And at the time, I was sort of really concentrating on my rowing career, so, you know, it wasn't, I didn't have the fire in my belly at that point. But that then in 99 and leading up to 99, I'd done some work with Alan Woods in a bid with Battersea Power Station and the owners then of Battersea Power Station, Parkview, and Victor Wong, in developing a river bus service for Battersea. That again, as a result of them not pursuing the development, resulted in a non-starter. However, one of those three boats that I mentioned that ended up going to work for the MOD down in Plymouth came on the market, and the rest is history. We bought it, we started the service in 99, and actually at that point there was a competitor. Whitehorse Fast Ferries had started a six boat strong operation of fast ferries that were actually given the contract or the license to run by TFL alongside City Cruisers for the tour operation. So City had the new tour route and had committed to build new boats, and so did Whitehorse Fast Ferries. And I think that was a big evolution of the river, because it was led by TFL and the mayor, Ken Livingston, at the time. Investment was made, significant investment was made in the piers, and there was a vision for tour and river bus for the future. Sadly, I think it was number 13 casualty of river bus services, Whitehorse Fast Ferries, lasted less than a year. But again, I see some of the key elements that resulted in failure, and I made sure that I never made those mistakes myself. And it grew, and we also started to get bigger vessels. The first big vessel, 220-seater Hurricane Clipper, that really started making the numbers work, and gave that capacity that drove footfall and drove the economics far, far better for a viable operation.
So is it fair to say then that Thames Clippers is the accumulation of everybody else's failures over the years? Because, you know, ask 100 people in the street, do they think a ferry service on the river is a good idea? 99.5 people would say they would. But as you said, there's been 13 financial failures before we got to where we are.
You're absolutely right. And believe me, it's not for the faint-hearted. It is. But equally, we've also got to thank the likes of the London Docklands Development Corporation and Canary Wharf Group, or Canary Wharf Development as it was then, and now Canary Wharf Group, for having the vision of putting in the key piers, like Masthouse Terrace Pier on the Isle of Dogs, Greenland Pier at Surrey Quays, and Canary Wharf Pier. Without the LDDC's vision for a river bus service, we would have never got started. You know, we've got to look back at some of the great things that were put in place to allow growth and development work, and got to think about that in the future as the Thames Estuary grows further east. But you're absolutely right that there has been a benefit, or I have had a benefit from seeing the failures. And equally, you know, I wouldn't have chose any of the original eight river buses because they weren't really fit for purpose. But those three that we ended up with back in the end, that was built at the latter year of the river bus partnership, they were the right type of boat. And it allowed us to evolve with that.
So frighten me then. How many passengers now?
5.3 million.
A year. Wow.
A year.
Crikey. That's extraordinary. From nothing.
It is. It is. But it isn't without the support and help of many people throughout the years. More importantly, the amazing team that I now have behind me.
And I guess lots of people think this is a service that TfL prescribes, funds, and gets Thames Clippers to operate. But that's not right, is it?
No, we do not receive any subsidy. We have had some subsidy through the way that was quite pinnacle in allowing us to grow and allowing us to demonstrate that it could become a commercially viable operation. And I'm pretty proud of that because we do not draw on the public purse anymore. And there are very many other major cities that have similar operations that cost the state a lot of money. And I, are quite pleased at the fact that we have, created a commercially viable, profitable, standalone business for our amazing city.
Amazing. So what's the busy bit then? Is this commuter traffic that's busy or is it tourists?
Commuter traffic is more spread out now. Ask me the busiest commuter route. It's from Putney, Wandsworth, Chelsea, Battersea in the west, coming into town and down to Canary Wharf. That is now sort of the busiest at any one point. It's sort of very much spread out as a result of, or post-COVID and the change of working patterns. The east has never sort of really returned to its original occupancy, but there is far, far more leisure taking place between those suburban peers these days as well.
So the commuter bit, that's all COVID consequence, right? There was a reasonable growth on both sides, and post-COVID, it's more spread, and now it grows on the west more than on the east.
Correct,
which
yeah.
Which is strange, actually, because all that development on the Thames on the east side, all the way out to Barking, looks like it should be ideal, but those developments just running slowly.
You've got to look at the occupancy of the likes of Canary Wharf and the city. You know, we hear of so many hospitality and retail elements struggling in those locations because they haven't got that day-to-day footfall that they used to. I'm really pleased at the rate of return on the west. We're actually beyond our 2019 numbers during that commuter period. Whereas I would say east is about 75%.
Yeah, interesting. Interesting how the demographics work. So the other one I always think of, people assume the Thames is straight east-west, don't they? But that's not true. Canary Wharf is on the north side of the river. That is a long way south because of the way in which the river runs around the Isle of Dogs. So some of these journeys are longer in distance, aren't they, than they are directly. And the Thames is meandering all the way from the estuary out to Putney.
Yes, the Isle of Dogs is a big loop in the river. And then so is then the Greenwich Peninsula, albeit not quite as big. So you do go round a big S there, all the way from the Greenwich Peninsula up round the Isle of Dogs and then towards Wapping and the City of London. Journey times, the development of craft that we have done over the years has allowed us to be efficient and allowed us to be flexible and serve areas that would not normally have been served. So there is an advantage to that in that, when you're, fortunately we've got a couple of piers sort of on the pinnacle of those bends, and they're not well served by other forms of transport. Greenland Pier, for instance, at Surrey Quays. It's a good 10-12 minute walk to Canada Water or Surrey Quays. So using the boat over to Canary Wharf or into Tower Hill is a lot quicker. An example of where river is quicker than other forms of transport.
I mean, the thing I like about it, you know, no better way to come to work this morning than on a sort of sunny day, on the back, out in the open, cup of hot chocolate from the onboard cafe and bar. I mean, there's no better way to go to work, is there?
There isn't. And it's really sort of flattering, encouraging when you see everyday commuters constantly posting the highlight of their day, an image of sunrise with the sun in the middle of Tower Bridge, almost like a television screen. Yeah. With the sun rising on it. And
there's all those other people on the district line hammering together. No. Yes, absolutely. No, it's amazing. It's a fabulous way because it's nice and relaxed, because although the boats are going really fast, it feels very relaxed, doesn't it?
It does. And funny enough, I travelled up this morning and, you know, see a young mother with a baby in arms. This was about 8:45. Sitting in the seat with a cup of coffee, and the child was just staring out the window. I'm not so sure whether she may have even been doing a round trip just to get the baby asleep.
There we go. There's a ticket we should have, shouldn't we? Yeah. Get your baby to sleep. So the thing I always know, whenever there's a picture of the Thames on the news, in the newspapers and so on, there's always a Thames Clipper boat in it. Nothing to do with the story. It's just there are enough boats that when you get a picture, you always get a Thames Clipper inside it. And the other thing, of course, is that people talk to me now and think it's owned by Uber. So how did that come about?
Well, just for clarity, it's not owned by Uber. It's still owned by Thames Clippers, Collins River Enterprises. We are very proud, though, to have Uber as a partner. And that deal came about in late 2019. Prior to that, we had all finance-related entities sponsoring us, other than the very first one. Mustn't forget that first one. It was sponsored by Berkeley Homes, and they commissioned Damien Hirst to do his polka dot design on a Hurricane Clipper, and it operated between Tate Modern and Tate Britain when it was first delivered in 2002. Well, actually, we didn't start running that until 2003. But that was our sort of first brand partnership. And then we'd done quite a few pop-ups with the Tates, Monet branding of one of the smaller boats. But when AEG got involved in 2006, they turned it up a notch, and we secured a brand partner with NatWest. We then went on to KPMG during the Olympics, and then MBNA, the credit card. And then in 19, we got Uber. So Uber was our sort of first transport partner, which was quite exciting. And it has worked really, really, really well.
So this is like Uber's strategy, isn't it? You can buy your rail tickets, you can buy your airline tickets, you can buy tickets on Thames Clippers. So this is part of Uber becoming a dominant transport retailer, I guess.
Yeah, and it's, you know, their ticketing app works well. It's globally known. You know, you can't criticize, you can't fault our Oyster and contactless system, and I know Oyster's beginning to phase out, but you know, our TfL ticketing system is just amazing. It's fantastic. It reduces queues. It keeps the flow going. But the great thing about the Uber app, alongside our own app, is that it allows people that are not that necessarily familiar with London and with how getting around London, and it's making more and more people aware of the alternative forms of transport. And, you know, we want to develop the app to make it even more guest-friendly and improve that passenger journey.
And then on top of that, Uber's name is on the outside of all of the vessels, which means that whenever you're walking over the bridges or you're walking along the embankment, the Uber name is going past you every few minutes.
They're certainly very, very prominent now. I don't know of any other global icon or city that is so well represented by Uber.
No, it's amazing. Now, the other thing that the river has had a bit of a reputation for is, of course, about pollution. So good news at Thames Clippers, the first hybrid boats.
Yeah, well, we're also hoping that the river's going to be a lot cleaner with the new Thames Tideway Tunnel.
Because as we're recording this, the Tideway is finally in operation. We've watched it be built over the last decade or so. Andy Mitchell, who's chief executive at Tideway, was the construction director at Elizabeth Line. He often jokes about how he built a tunnel that now millions of people use every day, and has now built a tunnel that humans have left for the last time for 50 years. Which I think that's a great story. So Tideway is now in operation, so we're no longer pouring raw sewage into the river, which means the fast-flowing river will clean itself up now very, very quickly. But then there is the emissions from the vessels.
Yes, there is emissions from vessels, as there are anything that is driven by a combustion engine. But we are working hard to reduce them. We have now got three hybrid vessels in service. That hasn't been easy. It's been a challenge, but we are now beginning to see some light at the end of that tunnel. Basically what happens is that they charge themselves. So the combustion engine turns a great big e-motor, charging the batteries whilst it's at high speed, coming up from the east and the west. And then in the central section, which is predominantly between Battersea and just below Tower Bridge, we're on 100% battery.
So this is the same development that the buses and taxis and so on have had, which is broadly a self-charging electric vehicle. So there's an engine which goes, which creates electricity that feeds the batteries, and then when the batteries are full enough, it can run on battery power.
Absolutely. And I'd say marine is probably about 15 years behind land.
But well, that's it is so big, right? That's
absolutely. And you know, there is some benefits to very, very large vessels. They don't actually disbenefit from that weight adding, which batteries do. And that's probably been the biggest challenge for us is making sure that we meet all the safety regulations from a stability perspective and everything else, alongside sticking 9 tonne of batteries in the boat.
Nine tonne
of batteries.
Golly. Where do the batteries come from?
The batteries are supplied from a European supplier, Flowtech, supplying our next two vessels that are currently in build. Well, actually, one was launched last week. And that really is a game changer. That one is 100% electric.
No motors?
No motors at all, other than the motor between the battery and the propeller. And that is a cross-river ferry that will replace the existing ferry that's been on that route between Surrey Quays and Canary Wharf for the last 20 years. There has been a service going across that part of the river for over 30 years. And we have had to build a lot of new infrastructure to facilitate this operation, because it's going to have to have an automated docking system to minimise the amount of power that the vessel needs to operate on its minute and 30 seconds crossing. So the docking element is the longer bit of the process.
So actually the docking takes longer than the crossing the river.
Absolutely. And then the way it's been designed, there are segregation for foot passengers and cyclists. So you cycle on one end and cycle off the other.
So that's a river crossing I think a lot of people don't even know about. So that's from Canary Wharf Pier across to the other side, broadly at Rotherhithe by the Hilton Hotel.
Yes. And the intention there is just to fulfil a wish of the mayor to have more crossings across the river. Bridges create issues for the navigation of vessels below Tower Bridge. And as you know, Tower Bridge opens, so it doesn't actually restrict anything up as far as London Bridge too much. And in order to have a bridge, it's got to have a long runway in from either side of the river. So it's sort of counterintuitive. And, you know, you look at the QE2 bridge, how far that has to start inland and on the other, when it gets to the other side. And then tunnels, you've got to get down to them. And Greenwich Foot Tunnel is a great piece of engineering, but you've got to rely on those lifts to get your backwards and up and down with your bikes. This will deliver a seamless process that is not restricting the navigation of other vessels that are going up and down the river. And I see this type of ferry operation evolving all the way down as the Thames Estuary develops.
So more cross rivers.
More cross river pedestrian. People see the river as a barrier.
Yeah. And it's the further east you get, the wider it is.
Absolutely.
The bigger the barrier.
Yeah.
It is interesting. You and I are old enough to remember that, of course, the original Dartford Tunnel was called the Dartford Purfleet Tunnel in order to give equality to both Essex and Kent. Purfleet soon got dropped. But it does, at that point, the Queen Elizabeth II Bridge covers a huge mouth of the River Thames, is used by tens of thousands of vehicles daily. But people are always complaining there aren't enough crossings on the east side. We're just about to get Silvertown Tunnel within a few weeks of this podcast. So there's huge demand, isn't there, to get from one side to the other?
There is. And, you know, things do come around full circle. I spoke earlier of all the failures of river bus services. I mean, some of them were before my granddad's time, not alone mine. But things come round full circle, and it's great to see the river coming back to use. In fact, the vessel that we're just about to replace, that combustion engine twin-hulled ferry that goes between Surrey Quays and Canary Wharf, called the Twin Star. And there was three Twin Stars, Twin Star 1, Twin Star 2. And they used to run between Belvedere and Dagenham. And that was before the crossing that you just mentioned. And its sole purpose was to allow Southside workers to park at Belvedere and get the ferry over to Dagenham, where they worked in the Ford car factory. And obviously, when the bridge had come along, that put pay to the need for that ferry. And we bought one of those ferries secondhand, and as it was an ideal, it was shallow drafted because it had to get to you know, quite shallow waters on the south side at Belvedere. So it was ideal for this route between Surrey Quays and Canary Wharf.
Amazing. I'm not sure if I ever told you, back in 1998, I worked on this amazing project. There was a plan when the O2 was the dome. There was a plan to run a passenger hovercraft from the M25 QE2 bridge on the south side, park and ride site, to the dome and fly it up that ramp and drop it outside the front entrance. Now, for those of you who know the river, you know it never happened. And it was a marvellous project. I'm glad we didn't get involved in it because the dome itself was catastrophic failure. So the numbers of people who would have come on the hovercraft, even if we could have overcome the noise, even if we could have flown it up the ramp, and even if we could have got past the VVIP entrance, which is where that ramp actually ended. So there's one of those things that might have been. But in fact, the O2 has now become a great draw for us, hasn't it? And certainly if I come out of a concert, there's 20,000 people queuing for the Jubilee line, and I'm turning right to get the boat.
The O2 was probably the biggest turning point in Thames Clippers' history. Because in 2006, the American that bought the Dome and turned it into the world's greatest entertainment venue, he shared my vision of a river bus service. And he invested heavily. He bought the majority stake in the business. And he invested heavily in 2007 and 8. And we trebled our fleet size, and you know, delivered almost six times the capacity because they were all big boats. And, you know, we transported the very first act at the O2, John Bon Jovi, from central London with his band to the O2 for the opening night.
Fantastic. There's an honour. And we've had the Royal Family. We've had, we were there, were we not, for the Diamond Jubilee?
We were.
The wettest day of the whole year, as I remember.
That was probably our very first engagement with Battersea Power Station. We wasn't operating from there at the time, but development had started, and I managed to get permission to lay the entire fleet on their jetty whilst we watch Her Majesty pass along with the flotilla.
I do remember, and it poured down with rain. The Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh, of course, were on the barge, getting completely soaked. The one occasion I ever met the Queen, she asked me if I'd been at the Jubilee, and I said I was on Hurricane Clipper, but I was underneath a roof, but the rain was so hard it bounced off the deck, and I told her I got soaked from the bottom upwards, and she just looked at me and said, "At least you had a roof," and moved on.
Yeah, it was very frustrating. That day was so wet, as you say. It was you didn't even have any beads on the windows of rain. It was coming down so hard. It was just washing straight down.
And what should have been a happy leaning over the deck at the back, watching it all go on. We were just all huddled together in the bar, trying to keep dry. I remember. And then we've got a new venture, haven't we? So yesterday, guess where I was? I was in Clipper Lounge, which is the new venture at Embankment Pier, which is a pier that has got a bit of a history as far as we're concerned. Just tell us about Clipper Lounge in the future.
It's always been important for the future of our operation to ensure that our guests have a great experience from the minute they touch any of our infrastructure, whether it be a website or whether it be stepping onto a pier. And there, again, be confronted by a great member of staff. So Clipper Lounge is sort of the first of a vision of creating or extending that experience to our guests. So they can endure a coffee, a bit of time relaxing, bit of time working, catching up. There's not much you can't do at Clipper Lounge Embankment. And when your boat does come in, you're only about 20 steps away from it. So it's a nice, easy transfer from the lounge onto the boat, and vice versa. When you're getting off, it's a nice way to end your journey before you move on to your onward plans.
Indeed. Well, from my observation, people go in there for a drink before they get the 6 o'clock boat. And since they haven't finished their drink, they have another drink and wait for the 6:30 boat, and then the 7, and then the 7:30, and then they leave there about 9, having had two or three drinks. So we quite like that as a notion. If you haven't finished your drink, you can get your drink put in a plastic glass and taken on the vessel. So that's not a problem. So any plans for any more?
Yeah, I think we've got to demonstrate first that that Embankment works, because it's probably one of the better places that we could have picked to start the first one. But yeah, I do see the opportunity for more in the future. And in particularly as we go further east, we own Gravesend Pier now, down at Gravesend. And it is our intention to run a service as far as Gravesend at some point. And, you know, to have that departure lounge or departure lounges in central London, and indeed down there when you're coming in of a morning or evening, if you're going out for the evening, it will grow and develop that customer experience. In fact, there's, you know, a lot of stuff in the press at the moment about Heathrow Airport, and I was only reflecting the other day and talking to somebody about Boris's vision of an airport in the Thames Estuary, and I know that met a lot of criticism, and I don't actually think it was a crazy idea.
Not at all. I lived through it in TfL. I remember Boris Island. I remember it well.
And I had him on the boat one day, and I said to him, I said, I've got this vision of creating these departure lounges in central London for people going down to your new airport by boat. And he looked at me and he said, "You mad?" I said, "Whoa, they say you're mad thinking of the airport." I said, "I think my idea is a lot less mad. I'm connecting it in an amazing with an amazing form of transport."
Absolutely. Well, that all resonates with me because my first job in the Department of Environment, as it was then, mm-hmm. back in the late 70s, was as part of the Third London Airport and the Maplin Development Authority, which is the precursor of Boris Island. It was the Foulness Maplin airport plan. We did in fact build a piece of concrete for Michael Heseltine to stand on to show that construction had started, but as everybody knows, it never got built, and the development at Heathrow and Gatwick carried on. Stansted was developed even further, and the story of airport expansion in the southeast is a book on its own. We better level with the audience, haven't we, because you were talking about AEG, but the majority shareholding in Thames Clippers now is Northleaf Capital, which is a Canadian infrastructure fund. You are, of course, still the chief executive, and I'm the chairman. So we better level that with the audience in case they think this is just an unashamed free advert, because the business involves the pair of us, which we enjoy enormously very much. So just in our last minute or two, what to look forward to in Clippers?
More innovation and development in our route to net zero. We've learned a lot. We've been a market leader. And I think there is a limit to what can be done in the immediate future. But you don't know until you've done it, and you don't know what the art of the possible is until you've taken those steps. And I think the future is great for our industry. We have got to develop at a sustainable and safe rate. And I'd like to think that one day we could be running with a hydrogen fuel cell and batteries combined. So the combustion engine replaces is replaced by a fuel cell. That said, though, I'm just going to leave on a bit of a plug. You know, most transport operations get duty-free on their fuel. There is a big duty on HVO, which is hydrated vegetable oil. And that is restricting us from expanding the use of that product. And I urge the government and legislators to review that and look to supporting more forms of transport in utilising that, because it you know, that is a relatively immediate support alongside the operation of batteries to take a vessel to nearly 100% emission free.
So HVO, which is a renewable, low emission fuel, could be expanded further across transport, including on the river, but is being spoilt by high rates of duty, which means it's actually more expensive for the operators to do the job with a sustainable and clean fuel.
Yeah.
There's one for the legislators. I know they listen to this episode, Sean, so look, I think that's a great place to leave it. I think we've agreed, if you're travelling anywhere east to west between Barking and Putney and all places in between, including Canary Wharf and Greenwich, Tower Pier, London Bridge, Embankment and so on, you should, without doubt, use Thames Clippers as the way of getting there. A, it's fun. B, you can use your Oyster, tap on and tap off bank cards. There's a nice cafe bar on every vessel, which means you can have a drink or a cup of coffee or a sandwich. If you're passing through Embankment, you can go to Clippers Lounge, which opens 11 o'clock every morning, and spend your day or some of your time there. And finally, coming down the pipe, greener vessels, more vessels, an exciting future, I think, for Thames Clippers. Sean, thank you very much.
Thank you, Leo.
Cruising on the water, feel that breeze. Zooming past the sides, oh, what a tease. London's lights are shining in the sky.